Hi everyone, welcome back. We are here in Galway and this week I'm with Peter Shelley. Hi Peter.
How are you?
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Peter has come from Navan this morning and we're going to sit down and talk about your beautiful little daughter Ayla. So I suppose a good place to start would be really with yourself, your partner Sarah. You guys, when did you guys first meet?
Oh, you've put me on the spot straight away.
Now you're in trouble. A long time ago.
So it wasn't that long time ago. So it was just before COVID.
Okay.
Shortly before COVID. I had been married previously. I have a little boy called Tom.
Lovely.
He's 10 now. Separated. And yeah, before COVID, I met Sarah.
Okay.
And yeah, I suppose as time went on, COVID accelerates things probably a little bit quicker. You have to have your circle of friends and you have to have those people who you're going to choose to hang out with. And I suppose we chose each other.
Lovely.
As time went on, we just decided, like, she was absolutely brilliant with Tom. From the start when she met him, she's a primary school teacher in a Gael school. Tom goes to a Gael school. So they would actually have a bit of fun over me not being so good at speaking Irish. And even over COVID, they were making videos for Sarah's junior infants class. And Tom would be on baking with Sarah and she'd send them with that with the class. And
yeah,
he'd go to the summer camps in her school then as well, get to meet all the kids. So he's nearly like this famous child turning up because he was after being on these videos with Sarah.
Oh,
and then
novelty.
The fact that he lives with Mentor Sarah is like just a total novelty for the other kids. So yeah, I suppose then it came to the stage where we decided, okay, we wanted to have our own family.
Okay.
And when Sarah got pregnant, and unfortunately, 11 weeks in, found out that it was a miscarriage.
Right. How was that for you? Like, you can remember that day. How did you find out?
I actually wasn't there.
Yeah.
I wasn't there. Sarah does a lot of charity work for Deborah Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in Kerry and she was climbing over the Kerry Mountains to raise money for Deborah Ireland and got back to the hotel room and had the miscarriage.
Okay.
Then, I'll be totally honest in everything I say today. And there's probably a little bit of disconnect from me then and we've spoke about this recently at home where I had Tom and it was my first experience of a miscarriage and you're nearly separated for it. It's not my body. There's been no physical change really in Sarah in terms of what I can see. And I'm still thinking, okay, well, we can go again, like, and we can hopefully have success in the future, which thankfully we did.
Mm.
So she got pregnant. She had Cara, who's now 3. She was born on the 15th of September. And yeah, shortly after that, Sarah always wanted sisters. I have a sister, so it's myself and my sister, and she has a brother, so it's herself and her brother. And no matter what, she always wanted, two girls, no matter what. Anytime we spoke to her, it was all about the sisters. I think a lot of her friends have sisters. She sees that relationship. Her mom has a real good relationship with her sisters, and she felt like she never got it, and she always wanted Cara to have that.
Yeah, that's her dream.
Yeah.
I get that. I had a sister. You know, it's a lovely relationship to have. Yeah. I can see why she'd want it for her kids.
Yeah. And then, so she got pregnant again. And unfortunately, back to the same as what happened before.
Really?
Around the 11-week mark, miscarriage.
Wow.
Again,
I suppose just for dads that are tuning in, going through miscarriage, how did you
this one is
take
different.
That? Yeah?
Yeah?
It rattled you?
This one is different.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose we've had Cara and you're just thinking to yourself, okay, this is what we have to go through again.
Mm.
It's heartbreaking. I think the worst thing about a miscarriage is not many people know that your partner is pregnant and then there's a suffering and silence then that's attached to that. And something I speak about now on a regular basis is how hard that can be. But I also want to be honest and say, yeah, from a man's point of view and for someone who has a boy and a girl now at that stage, you are thinking, okay, well, it's happened before and we can definitely get through it again.
Okay, yeah.
So thankfully, Sarah got pregnant then on Ayla. We found out in March of 2024. And
how was the pregnancy? Good?
Pregnancy, absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
Sarah's brilliant on both Cara and Ayla. Like, no complaints. She's someone who just gets up and goes and gets on with stuff. You wouldn't even know she was pregnant at parts. Like, we have a picture of the day she went into the hospital, and we would joke saying that my bump is probably bigger than her bump. So so that will give you a good idea of how slim she is and how slim she was throughout both pregnancies as well.
And when you were pregnant with Ayla, did you find out? Because she had wanted this girl. No.
So, that leads to its own challenge then, because there was reduced movement towards the end, and Sarah had a section on Cara, and she had been booked in for a section the Friday of the following week, and she just wasn't feeling great. And the Sunday, we said, look, I'll drop you in, dropped her in, and then suddenly she's staying in the hospital.
Oh, okay.
So, again, nothing major to worry about. Basically, they said to her, look, had they reassured her with what they had done? And she sort of said, yeah, but I'm still not feeling as many movements. And they said, look, just stay.
Okay, fair enough. They take things like that very seriously, don't they?
Yeah.
Can I ask just as well, so we don't rush past it, how was Tom?
And, this is a good, this is
so you told Tom there was a baby coming. How did he find?
Yeah, so I think the first one, this probably speaks of how important and precious Ayla is to all of us, because when we told Tom that Cara was coming, a total different reaction to what we got when Ayla was coming. When we told him over dinner that Cara was, that he was going to have a brother or sister.
Yeah.
And he got really upset and he left the, now remember, he's only 6 or 7 at this stage. He's left the kitchen table. He's gone to the living room. He sat on the sofa and he is crying his eyes out.
Oh, the poor thing.
And eventually we left him be, left him with his thoughts. And then he came back and he says, okay, it's okay. I'll have a brother. As if to say, okay, you can pick now what you want.
I'll put in my order.
Yeah. With Ayla, it was the total opposite. When we told him that Sarah was pregnant again, he was absolutely delighted.
Was he?
And he didn't care whether it was a boy or a girl.
Oh, bless
him. He was delighted that there was another baby going to be joining us.
And Shakara is probably too little to understand.
Cara hasn't got a clue.
Okay.
Cara hasn't got a clue what's going on.
What age is Cara at this stage?
Cara is...
ish. She's probably about 1.5.
She's 3 now, so yeah.
So you're gearing up for baby number 2 and you're coming to the end of the pregnancy.
Yeah.
I suppose even practically, you know, you're getting the house ready, all those things in place for little baby number 2 coming. You haven't found out the sex.
No.
But you're crossing the fingers for a girl.
Sarah's crossing the fingers for a girl. I don't really mind.
Yeah.
But then when she gets taken into hospital on that Sunday, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking to myself, okay, what type of challenge is this going to bring if it is a boy? So suddenly I'm thinking, okay, I want a girl as well now. Like, I want it to be a girl. And Sarah is great for journaling. So she's writing down all this in a pregnancy journal. And she's talking about, she has in it, like, I really hope this baby is a girl. I'm not going to come bond with it if it's a boy. This is the last few things she's writing down. And the following day, she's told we're going for the section. So she had a choice to wait out till the Friday or to have it the following day. And she said, well, what's the chances? She had all types of sweeps. She had movements where they were trying to move the baby and nothing. And she said, well, what am I waiting till Friday for? I might as well just go in.
And they'd be very much the hospital as well, as, you know, baby's cooked.
Yeah, exactly.
Sooner rather than later, get them out. Yeah.
So next day she was due to go first thing for the section, and an emergency section happened that morning. So she was pushed out and I was in the hospital with her waiting to go in. And yeah, we went in. Everything seemed normal compared to what happened, like with Cara and what happened. Tom was a section as well, so what happened with Tom. And just really emotional compared to the first two. Compared to Tom, compared to Cara, the two of us cried our way through that section. And we look back at it now and we ask why. Like, and we've said, like, maybe it, like, we had said that was it. We were done. Like, there was going to be no more kids. So this was the last one, regardless of whether it was a boy or a girl. And obviously this baby is pulled out of Sarah's stomach then, and big head of dark hair, nothing like either of the other two. And it's a girl.
Aww.
And the tears just flow completely.
Okay. Over the moon.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if I'm more over the moon for me or I'm more over the moon that, okay, Sarah's got what she's wanted. And yeah, there's just a sense of, okay, this is everything that we wanted now and we're through.
Also, you know, you'd had those losses in there too. And I know, of course, Cara arrived, you're blessed with Tom. But those losses do make you appreciate when a healthy baby arrives, doesn't
definitely.
It? You know?
Definitely.
Yeah.
And yeah, look, in terms of after that, Sarah being Sarah, I think she stayed in for 2 days, like after a section. She was up and ready to go, wanted to get home. It was November, so the 17th of November, she's sitting at home again. And we've got the Christmas tree up. Yeah. We have all the decorations up. And she is in bed with coffee every morning. With a baby and with Christmas movies on the TV.
It's bliss.
Yeah.
What did Tom make of Aileen when she arrived home?
So Tom, if you look back at the photos of Tom, like the smiles on his face, and it was like he automatically went into protective big brother.
Mm.
Because Tom is smart, but he's very emotional.
Mm.
Cara's wild. Like Cara is the opposite. Cara is like, she's smart, but she is wild. She is extremely funny, but she has no sense of her own strength. So she is all about the baby, all about climbing up on the sofa and giving her a cuddle and every now and then giving her a whack when someone isn't looking. And so Tom is that protective big brother. So when we see the photos of the three of them together, Tom is holding Ayla and he's nearly fending off Cara in the background.
Yeah, yeah.
Like there's one where Tom's leg is in the air and he's holding Ayla in one arm, but he is trying to fend off Cara in the other one. So yeah, absolutely delighted. And look, he was the same when Cara was born, but just a different level of what it meant. I think that he had his two sisters and that was it.
It's so gorgeous. You know, that time is so precious, I think, when we look back, as you well know now, but when you look back, sometimes when you're in a moment, you don't really appreciate it. But especially when you have a couple of kids, you begin to appreciate it in the moment a little more, I think.
Yeah.
And I suppose coming up to Christmas, it's the ideal dream setup. You're sitting at home and it's cozy and you're probably having visitors over admiring this new baby.
Yeah. And it's funny. I think maybe when you have your first child, there's a big rush to come to your house for people to see the baby. Panic. And then you have the second one. So then Cara comes along and just people coming over. And then Ayla comes along and it's not as busy. It's definitely not as busy in the house.
Yeah.
And there's multiple reasons. Like I think about like my own parents, my grandparents are in their 90s and they were having a rough time of it in the build up to Christmas. So they weren't well.
Yeah.
My mom and dad are the main people who look after them. And so, yeah, we haven't got as many people calling, but that's nice
as well.
Which
is good because it's nice, you're soaking up the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And Tom is obviously from a previous relationship. So Tom spends one Christmas with his mom and then he spends one Christmas with me. So last year was his Christmas with me. So we had from the school holidays, that whole build up to Christmas, going to see Santa, going to Tato Park with them. With my sister and her kids and my mom and dad, and that's something that we've done for the last few years where we all just have one day out together. Then just the build up to Christmas Day itself, and everything is just perfect.
And how was Ayla as a baby? Sarah was breastfeeding.
Sarah was breastfeeding. So yeah, if anything, I would say like I'm probably not the right person to even speak about Ayla because Sarah did absolutely everything.
Okay.
My job was to look after Tom and look after Cara and look after Sarah where I could. But in terms of Ayla herself, absolutely perfect. The biggest challenge that we had in those first few weeks was Sarah had a blood clot in her section.
Wow.
So she spent a lot of time going back and forth to Hollis Street, getting looked at. And I would say in the 8 weeks and 2 days that Ayla was with us, it was probably twice where Sarah wasn't there. And no longer than an hour each time.
Mm.
So one was, she went around to see some neighbours, left Ayla in the sitting room with me while I was watching the football on the TV. She was actually sitting on a beanbag thing the whole time. So there was no even looking after from my point of view. Sarah had her fed and changed and everything. And the second time was when Sarah had to go back into hospital for an MRI. Obviously, Ayla couldn't go in with her, so I went to the hospital. I walked Ayla until Sarah was done. So Sarah did absolutely everything.
But in herself, Ayla was a
She was a brilliant baby.
Energy, was she placid? You know, sometimes you get very cranky babies.
No, no, not at all. She was just so chilled out. So her Ayla means a little fiery one, is what it translates to from Irish. She was far from it.
Really?
She was so chilled out. 3 weeks in, she was giving big, proper smiles at Sarah. Sarah had organised for us to go and have a professional photo shoot. Something I was probably against at the
time.
I was just thinking, like, look, I enjoy photography myself, and I was thinking, I can do that. Like, I can take those photos.
But then you wouldn't be in them.
yeah. And maybe that's what I wanted as well. But,
So I suppose if you keep it back in there, so you get your newborn photo shoot.
Mm-hmm.
She's still the big head of black hair, by the way.
Still got the
Did
big
she?
Head
no, sometimes
of
they
black
lose
hair.
It.
Yeah, she was a big baby. She was 8 or 13.
Wow. That's a big baby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cara was 6'9". So big difference. So she's actually in Baby Grows now that Cara was in when she was that bit older.
God.
So a lot of the photos we would have comparison photos where Cara is in this as a 3-month-old and Ayla's in it as a 1-month-old. So,
wow.
Beautiful, healthy
baby.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I suppose, let's say bringing us forward to a couple of weeks later, you are doing really well.
Yeah.
And you're out one day.
Yeah. Christmas at home. We actually went to La Hinch. I mentioned to you off air. We spent a lot of time at La Hinch. So went to La Hinch the following day, the 26th, which is my birthday. And we spent some time over the holidays, whether it be Christmas, summer, Easter, Halloween, down at La Hinch. Sarah's dad is from there. And came home, I'm thinking it was the 5th of January, and then I had to go back to work on the 6th of January, which was all good. If anything, Sarah is praying for this day where the 6th of January comes and I'm going back to work, and suddenly she's a mom of two, is what she would see it as. That was her first time being a mom of two. That was the 6th, the 7th, then the 8th was the Wednesday, and the sky in wintertime, like I mentioned, I'm into photography, so I like taking photos of sunsets, sunrises, nature mainly. And Cara had got this idea of like the pink and blue sky, and just so she was just amazed. She was going to her childminder during the day, but you'd pick her up at 4 o'clock. That's when the sun is going down and the sky is just multiple different colours. And on the Wednesday, I said, look, we'll go for a walk up to the hill at Tara after we pick Cara up. And whatever happened that day work-wise, I couldn't go. And I said to Sarah, look, I'm going to have to give it a miss. And she said, not to worry, plenty of days ahead of us. So I'll go collect Cara, or I'll go collect Ayla, brings Cara with her, brings her home. And the Thursday then, I said, okay, look, no matter what we do today, like, I know I'm busy with work. I've been off for a while, but I said, let's go for that walk this evening. And I've been checking on an app what the sunset was like. It was looking good. And I said, yeah, okay, let's go. So 4 o'clock or 20 to 4 came. We went, picked up Cara from the childminder, and we drove over to the hill of Tara. So we're over there for probably 10 past 4. Sarah gets Ayla into the sling. I have Cara in her welly boots and her wet gear. The snow on the hill. The snowmen built around the place, scattered around, but the hill of Tara, it looks a bit like what you'd see on the Teletubbies. Like, it's those little hills where the kids can run up and down them and slide the other side. Like I said, Sarah has Ayla in the sling. She has her dry robe on over her, but it's open. And yeah, it's just going for a walk. Like, that's all it is at the end of the day. We went for a walk. And we're up there, Cara's sliding up and down the hills, and eventually we said, better go home. Like, Ayla was starting to get a little bit cranky in the sling. And Sarah, being Sarah, like, Sarah's very attached to nature, just decided, I'll just feed her here. Like, who cares? Like, so that's it. She's feeding her out in the middle of the hill of Tara. And you're looking at Sarah going, yeah, that's her all over. Like, she loves nature, she loves hiking. And yeah, it didn't seem anything unusual still. So myself and Cara had walked ahead, and we had found the snowman, and we were knocking the head off the snowman, and we were then going to make our way down. I had given Sarah the car keys and she was saying she'd walk ahead, but actually Ayla had settled at this point and she said, no, I'll wait. And within 5 minutes, we're down at the back of the car. I've Cara's wellies off and her wet gear off, and she's back in the seat. And then I hear a shout from the boot where Sarah had gone to take Ayla out to put her into, to take her coat off and to put her into her car seat, and the colour had drained from Ayla's face. And yeah, that's where everything changes. So I suppose you if you go through something like this, there's two ways you can go about it. You can either freeze or you can go into, okay, something has to be done. Sarah froze at the back of the car with the initial shock and started crying, and I grabbed Ayla and ran for the cafe at the hill. So I thought, okay, I need to get in somewhere warm and I need to get her stripped down and see what's going on. As I made my way to the hill, a man had heard the screams, or to the cafe, a man had heard the screams from the top of the hill and made his way down, and he was a doctor, and made his way into the cafe. And at this stage, I'm on the phone to the ambulance, or to the emergency services. And I've got Ayla stripped down to next to nothing on one of the tables in the cafe. And the cafe is about to close. Like, there's nobody in there. The tables are all cleaned and everything. They're pretty much about to lock the door when I come barging through. And I start to work on Ayla, and I probably get one round of CPR in, and this doctor arrives with his equipment and he takes over and helps me. And you know, you don't know what you're thinking then. Like, you just go into it. This has to be done. Like, even when I talk about it now, you're talking about it as if it's like just a story that, okay, this is what happens. Because this is a matter of fact in terms of what happened at this point. Nineteen minutes later, the ambulance arrives. The doctor had like some equipment that he could track Ayla's heartbeat and stuff, and it was like a shock that he would give her. He gave her one.
You obviously knew when you got into the cafe that, or she wasn't. Did you check for a pulse?
Check for a pulse, check for breathing, checked her airway while I was talking to the ambulance, cleared her airway, make sure her tongue wasn't down.
They were guiding you through all this?
Some of it I was doing, and some of it they were telling me to just do it. Instinct. And I'm telling him, I've done that already. And he's saying, okay, you need to do it again. Okay. And I'm checking it again.
So the doctor is
The doctor's there. In, and suddenly the doctor's, we're still getting the guidance over the phone, but the doctor's really leading the way at this point. Yeah. And I'm just doing whatever he tells me to do. Sarah's now in the shop, part of the cafe. She has Cara in her arms, and I can hear the screaming and shouting from there. The staff are looking after her as best they can. They're keeping her out of the room, out of the cafe part. And yeah, look, you still have hope that when you go through that first shock, we didn't have to do that again. So in my head, I'm thinking, she's back. She's back here. Like, we're not going back to do that shock again. Like, the doctor's checking. And he's saying, no, we're not going to do it. And he's stepping away from it. And we go back, we'll continue to do CPR together. And then he's checking again a couple of seconds later. No, we don't need that. Let's keep going. So at that point, you're still hopeful that she's going to be okay. The ambulance turns up 19 minutes after the phone call. And they start to work on her. And they're not really giving anything away. Like, you're not looking going, okay, is this happening? Is she okay? Is she not okay? You don't know what to think at this point. Eventually they get her into the ambulance. They're asking for permission to do certain things, and you're like, whatever has to be done, you do whatever you have to do to make sure she's coming home with me. Like, and you get into the back of the ambulance with her, and then I move to the front, and in the front, I'm driving in, and I'm like, it's stranger things that go through your head, because we're driving and I'm going, I wouldn't drive this way. Why are you driving this way? Like, I'm thinking, and like, there's a quicker way to get to the hospital than this route. But the driver is obviously these are trained professionals. They know where they're going. But the driver is also now having a conversation with me about work, about anything he can do to take my head off what's going on in the back of the ambulance.
Right. And where is Sarah at this stage?
Sarah's still at the Hill of Tara. Okay. So I have, on the way, I've rang a friend of mine and I've said to him,
go get
you
her.
Need to get up to the Hill of Tara. Yeah. Like, Sarah can't drive. I've also rang my parents who are out Dunleary way. So they've got an hour trip from Dunleary to Navan to Sarah, because Sarah needs to get into the hospital to me as quick as possible.
And this is evening time.
Someone needs to be there with Cara. Yeah. And Sarah can't drive from Navan by herself. Initially, we were told the Garda car would go to the house and the guards would bring her in, but nothing happened along that way. We had two friends there. They put Sarah in the car eventually and they got her up and my dad was there then to look after Cara. But Sarah would say, like, my dad, he wouldn't say too much now. Like, he'd fairly quiet, like, and probably like most men. And he gave her a hug and she said, like, she just knew from the way that my dad hugged her that something was wrong. There was something worse that happened than what we had thought. At this point, I'm in the hospital.
So you arrive, you're in the front of the ambulance and Sarah's being taken care of. People are coming to help her.
Yeah.
What
so
hospital
my focus,
do you go to?
We go to Temple Street.
Okay.
You're brought into Temple Street and initially Ayla's brought straight to the resuscitation room. And I'm brought to the desk to check in. And they're asking me questions. And I am looking, sort of thinking, do you really, can we not do this tomorrow or the next day or whatever? And eventually someone comes and gets me and I don't fill in any paperwork. And I'm brought straight into the room. The room has about four beds in it. And my phone is about to die. And I'm thinking, oh my God, how am I going to contact Sarah? So I'm asking people, has anyone got a charger? One of them gets me a charger, plug the phone in. And again, I'm probably two beds away from where they're working on Ayla, but I can, that there's probably 20 people in the room working on her and I can see absolutely everything that's happening to her. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, like, they've got this, give them space, like, stay away. And at the same time, I'm keeping an eye on my phone to see where Sarah, like, where is she and when is she going to be here? I'm getting messages from her asking what's happening and I'm telling her they're doing all they can. Like, she's doing good, they're doing all they can. So even though I don't know what's happening, you're just telling her what you, but I'm thinking what I want to hear. So I'm telling her that.
Mm.
And eventually she tells me she's in the car. And around that same point, the doctor comes to me and says, look, explains that even though she's there, she's not really there. So the oxygen isn't getting up to her brain. The blood isn't moving around her body properly. And, you know, they can keep trying, but the recommendation now would be that I would make a decision. And I'm thinking, okay, Sarah's still not here. Like, I can't make that decision without Sarah being here. And they said to me, we can try two more times. And I'm thinking, okay, like, I had two times. What does that mean to me? Like, how many times have you tried so far? But I'm thinking, okay, you're the professionals. You're telling me what to do. And they're telling me, look, come closer to the bed. Come closer to the bed. Like, be with her. And I'm thinking, no, you need all the space that you can get there. Like, you don't need me sitting there in the way. And then eventually I realized that they're asking me to come closer for a reason. They're asking me to come close because this is the end now and that's it. So I sent Sarah one last message saying, still working on her, they're hopeful, but things aren't looking good. But when you just get in as quick as you can. And I went over to Ayla and I sat with her and I held her hand as everything stopped. And the room goes from 20, 25 people going 100 miles an hour to me and Ayla sitting at a bed. And some doctors standing in the distance and some doctors coming up and offering their condolences. And then I'm like, do I sit here with Ayla or do I go get my phone? Do I ring Sarah? And then suddenly then you're going into decision-making mode. You have to make decisions that you never thought you'd have to make. Like, you're being told that they're going to clean her up a little bit. They're going to move her. And what did I want to do about Sarah? Did I want to tell her? Should they tell her? Where was she? They need to catch her on the way in the door. She doesn't need to bump into anyone. She doesn't need to hear this. She doesn't need to see it. And I'm saying, look, I'll text her when she's nearly here. She'll text me. She'll let me know. I'll tell her to text her, to text me that I have to come and get her. And I said, like, no one else can tell her this. Like, I have to be the one that tells her what's happening here. And so they get Ayla cleaned up. They put a blanket around her. And then you leave the resuscitation room. And I'm carrying her in my arms. And I'm thinking, oh my God, look at this. Like, she's getting a guard of honor through the hospital. Like, Jesus, how precious is this? Like, she's passed away and she's getting a guard of honor. She wasn't getting a guard honor. They were standing in the doorways with all the doors closed to make sure that no other person had to see what I was seeing right then. But in my head, I'm thinking, here's all the nurses standing out, giving her the guard of honor that she deserves to get her from that room to this room that we're now going to. So I get to that room. I put her in a little cot that they have there for her. It's like a little chaplain maybe in the hospital. And again, I'm keeping an eye on my phone. There's a nurse there called Anna, and she's chatting away to me. And I'm thinking, okay, like, she's trying to go through the formalities of me. Like, she's telling me, look, the guards are going to be in. They're going to need a statement. These are all the things that are going to happen. Do you want to do them now or do you want to wait? And I'm thinking, nah, Sarah doesn't need to see any of this. So anything that needs to happen, let's get it moving before she gets in here. So that's all good. The guards come in, have a chat with them. I tell them the story I've told you. She's filling in some paperwork for me. I'm not signing anything. I'm just sitting there with Ayla. I'm looking at her. I'm in disbelief. And then I get the message to say Sarah's outside. So I'm thinking, okay.
Can I ask how much time has passed since you got there-ish?
Oh, so let's say we're back down from the hill, maybe a 4:30, and we're now, she passed away at 18:38 that evening. Let's say it was 45 minutes to drive in. So like there's a good hour and a half gone, I would say.
All of this has happened in an hour and a half.
And it's funny because it's only when you, well, it's not funny, but only when you sit down and you start to map out the time, that felt like hours, and hours and hours for me.
Yeah.
But actually, like, I remember sitting there thinking, come on, like, what is taking you so long to get up? Like, and
Tempest Street is a good distance away.
It is. And then you're going through, like, when that ambulance is on the way in.
You got there.
I'm looking there going, part of me is thinking, I can drive quicker than this. But another part of me is thinking,
yeah, well, probably
every
not.
Set of lights that you got to, there was a row of Garda cars stopped at. So it was like everybody knew. And like you're coming off the M3 by Blanche. You're going down into Phibsborough. There's a lot of traffic lights there.
Yeah.
That's all blocked off. It's like there's a row of Garda cars waiting. The second you go by them, they are gone by you again. And they've got the next junction.
Escort.
You are getting there as quick as you can.
Yeah. So that wouldn't have been the case for Sarah.
No. So she's there with her friends driving the car, coming in. And look, I don't know, would it have made any difference if the guards had went down and got it? She still had to wait for my mama to come. She still had to wait for several things to happen.
Yeah. You get the text to say she's outside.
She's outside. I tell the nurse, and the nurse gets someone to get her. And they at this point, they have brought me out of the room that I'm in and down to what they call the quiet room that at the time felt like a quiet room. And it's a room now bigger than this, and one glass window and a door. And Sarah turns the corner to come in the door, and the scream. I just knew. She knew. That's the bit that obviously Ayla leaving and how she left is hard, but like that scream from Sarah, that was all she ever wanted. And that scream I can hear loud and clear. And like, this is stuff I wouldn't even say to Sarah now. Like that's, but like, I remember that scream like it was yesterday. Like it happened before we walked in here. And yeah, she didn't want to go see Ayla straight away. And then she did. I suppose you don't know what you want. And we went back to the room. It's a Thursday evening. And we go back to the room where Ayla is, and we sat down with her, and she didn't want to hold her. And eventually she said she did, and she picks her up. And now remember, we've been on the hill at Tara. Like, I'm covered in muck from running around after Cara. Sarah's not looking much better. Like, she's in her hiking boots and whatever else. And I'm thinking, okay, I've had a bit of time with Ayla. Like, you haven't had anything. And 15 minutes later, like, the room is quite dark that you're in with the cat and with Ayla. And 15 minutes later, three or four nurses appear in the corner. And I ended up asking, why are you all here now? Like, Anna's been here with me the whole time. Like, and like, why is there more? And they're like, oh, she needs to go now. I'm thinking, Sarah's here 15 or 20 minutes. Like, she doesn't need to go anywhere. Like, what's the rush now that we have to go anywhere? And they take her. And we're under the impression of the next morning, we can come back and see her. So much so that the hospital are saying to us, don't even go home if you don't want to. Like, there's plenty of hotels. Book into a hotel. Stay nearby. You'll be getting a call in the morning. You can come back in and see her. So we left they asked us, were we ready to leave? And I said no. Sarah agreed. We weren't ready to leave. We couldn't stay in that room, but we could go back down to the quiet room that we had met in first. And when we went into that room, that room wasn't a quiet room. There's a ward. Obviously, the first time I went down there, I'm not aware of anything. I'm not hearing anything. I'm not seeing people. I'm in that room now, and the two of us are looking at each other, and all we can hear is screaming babies, screaming kids, crying. There's both sides of that room. There's a ward, and you can hear everything that's going on. And we just said, we can't stay here. And we picked up the plastic bag that they had given us with a few things in it. And we went outside, and we were told about hotels, and we thought, right, we didn't know what we were going to do. We didn't know, should we go to a hotel? Should we go home? What should we do? And we said, look, let's go to one of the hotels that they recommended first and get a coffee, try get some thoughts together and make a decision. So we went into that hotel, and obviously that hotel has no idea what's just happened. No. But here they are seeing two people coming in, and the best way to describe it is we look homeless at this point. Like, I've got no hoodie on anymore because there was blood on the hoodie. I've got bottoms that have mud all over them. I've got runners that have been absolutely filthy because this is all the stuff I was wearing on the hill. And Sarah's in her hiking gear, covered in mud. And you can see them looking us up and down, questioning, and I have this plastic bag with my belongings in it.
And also mentally, you've checked out, I'm sure. Yeah. You know what I mean?
But I can see them looking at me going,
distressed, obviously.
Well, we tell this person to leave. And yeah. I'm thinking, all I want is a coffee. And I think when I order a coffee, they accept that, okay, we can give them a coffee. Whereas I think had I asked for a beer or anything, I would have been told, we're not serving you, and off you go. So you go into decision-making mode and you have to make a call then on what you're going to do. Obviously, my parents know where we are. They know we're in the hospital and why we're there, but nobody else does. And I rang them to have a chat with them. Tom was due up the next morning, the next afternoon after school. And I was like, okay, we need to ring Tom's mum. We need to let Tom's mum know that Tom can't come up this weekend. Like, it's just not going to be a good place for him to be. So I rang home, my mum rang Tom's mum, gave her the news, and then a while later I gave her a call myself as well to have a quick chat about it and how we would try deal with that with Tom going forward. And we decided we weren't going to stay in a hotel. That what was the point in staying in a hotel? Like, my mum and dad are, at that time of night, they're 15, 20 minutes away. We'll get a taxi. And my dad insisted, no, I'll come in and get you. So my dad picked us up. We walked from Temple Street and we were close to Hollis Street when my dad picked us up. We just kept walking and walking and walking. And I'd ring him every once in a while and say, okay, now we're here, now we're here, now we're and we'd be telling him different places that we'd be, but we just started walking towards the house. And he picks us up and we bring us home, and they have to just two living rooms in my parents' house, and the front room is only ever used really at Christmas time. So we go there and the fire is lit in the front room. And that's where we sat down, and we, I don't know how many hours we sat there for.
In shock.
We just sat and sat and sat and thought about, who do we need to tell? Who do we need to call? What do we need to do? And we were given the impression that we can come back in the next morning. So like we were sort of hoping the time sped up that we could get to the hospital the next morning.
But also, just before we get to that, in those moments too, of course, you start thinking, what do we need to do here? Who do we need to call? But surely you're both, what's after happening as well?
Oh, you're in shock.
Complete and utter.
You don't realise what's happened. You don't.
Like in my head of you've gone for a walk, and we spoke there about how quickly this all happened. But even as you're walking out, you go for a coffee, like the world has no idea what's just happened.
Absolutely
to you.
Nothing.
And you've come home a couple hours later without your baby.
But you don't realise any of that at the time.
Do you
at
not?
That time.
You, what's
you
that don't, like?
I think for Sarah, she realised. For me, I'm in denial.
Okay.
For Sarah's breastfeeding, remember. So
yeah,
Sarah's body is relying on Ayla, and Ayla is relying on Sarah's body.
And that's still happening.
And that's still happening. So Sarah's now back in the house thinking, should do a feed now? And
I need to feed her.
I need to get this milk out of me. So she's pumping.
Poor thing.
And not only is she pumping, she's pumping, she's putting it in the bags. She's dating the bags as if it's going to be used at some point in the future.
Yeah.
And she is, like, she is just in, okay, that's what has to happen. We haven't told anyone now, apart from my parents at this stage. And we go to bed that night, hardly sleep. We wake up the next morning, you sit at home thinking, what time is the phone call coming?
And are you both longing to get into her?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of it more from Sarah's point of view, where I've had all this time with her. Because like I said, it felt like hours and hours for me. Even though it wasn't. Sarah's had 15, 20 minutes with her max, and I'm thinking Sarah needs to be with her.
Yeah.
So the call comes from the social care worker from Temple Street. And we have a conversation about what's going to happen next. And then I say, okay, that's great. Okay, now we'll come in now and see her then. Is that okay? And there's like a silence on the other end of the phone of, you're coming in today. And I'm like, we were told yesterday, Sarah had 15 minutes. We could come in and see her before absolutely anything happened. And leave it with me. Went off, came back, rang me. It's too late. The autopsy started. You can't see her. And I don't want to slate the hospital or the staff, because I don't want to give out about anyone, because everyone has their own stuff going on. And I think nurses especially are probably overworked and underpaid, and there's not enough of them. And yeah, everything had started. So whatever we were told the night before was irrelevant.
But I mean, so, and I know you don't want to give out about people.
Yeah.
We're talking about your experience here. This is really important too.
Oh, it's hugely important, because then what happens, because I am going to end up giving out about people essentially here, because
experience. We need to learn from people, and I imagine that was horrific for you both.
Oh, because it gets worse, because you're being told certain information and you're clinging on to that information going, okay, I can get to that point. Then you're being told that should be home with you on Saturday. Great. Okay. It's only one more day. We can make it through one more day. You'd have a phone call a few minutes later. You'd be told something else by someone else. And that was the Friday. It was phone call after phone call, information from one person and something else from someone else. And in the end, what happened was the head person rang me. I had it out with them on the phone about what I was told. He told me one thing. And 11 minutes later, I had a phone call from someone else. After him telling me nothing would happen again, to tell me something different again. And I just thought, what am I dealing with? Because for me, they weren't dealing with not even a child. They weren't dealing with a person anymore. It was like, well, this is the process and this is what has to happen. And you know, you signed a piece of paper. My pen didn't touch any paper. Nor Sana, who was beside me, did all the writing. I didn't write my name anywhere. Now, it turns out you don't need to have signed anything anyway. An autopsy has to happen. You can argue about it all you want. Like, and you can be brought to court over it. You can, yeah. I would want an autopsy to happen anyway. It's just
the manner of
how it happened.
So no one gave you a call to let you know that she's been taken off for an autopsy?
No. First call I got was social care worker. You need to organise a
funeral. And it was already started.
Yeah. Do you need a hand organising a funeral? I said, of course I do. I'm blessed that I had great grandparents in my life. I have grandparents in my life. I've lost two grandparents. I've lost one aunt. I've never had to organise any funeral. I've never had to be part of any of that. Mm. I still have two living grandparents now in their 90s. And so, yeah, of course I need a hand getting the funeral sorted. I don't know what I have to do next. But you're trying to juggle organising a funeral and you're trying to juggle, okay, we're meant to be in there. You told us we could go in. And for Sarah now, the last time Sarah saw her was when I took her out of her hands. Well, she saw her in the hospital for briefly.
Yeah.
You don't know if you're getting her back then Saturday, Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Monday morning, and you're getting all types of dates and times.
God.
And the only saviour that came with this was the funeral director.
Yeah.
A guy called Bobby Farrelly, and absolute saint, came to the house, sat down with us, explained everything that has to happen. And he has young kids himself, so I don't know if, and obviously he's surrounded by death all the time, but just the manner he had in speaking with us just was totally different. It was like speaking to us as parents, but as parents who'd lost a child. Yeah. And he sat down, he spoke with us, and his view was, I speak with the person in the hospital. And he went to a different person again, and he got all the information from that person and basically said to us that, I'll have her home on Monday for you. And that was the first time that we felt like, okay, we can believe that piece of information that we're getting. And yeah, so it's a long weekend sitting at home. Like, sitting at home Saturday, Sunday, waiting for the day to come on Monday. Like I mentioned there, about my grandparents and my dad's side have passed away. Like, I didn't go into the funeral home to see them. Like, I something about death that I don't like that side of it. I don't like sitting in a room with someone in a coffin, with the coffin open or closed. I just don't like that part.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously when it's your own daughter, that changes. So the Ayla gets brought back on the Monday to the funeral home. There's a bit of a push to have the funeral Monday or Tuesday. And I'm thinking, I'm going to spend as much time as I want with her here. So I'm sitting with the funeral director and I say, it can't happen on Monday or Tuesday. I've got people coming from abroad. And Sarah's looking at me like I have 10 heads saying, who's coming? Like, is your uncle coming from America or your aunt from Australia? I'm like, just shut up for a second. Like, just... So, yeah.
You needed that time.
Yeah. I wasn't ready to go.
If you had the funeral on Monday.
It was basically bring her home and go straight to it.
Go straight. See, yeah. There would have been no time for you or Sarah.
Yeah. And I think the other side of this was, what type of funeral do you want to have? So obviously I've a circle of friends who've gone through similar situations now. And some would have closed family.
Immediate family only.
Like,
yeah.
We had anyone who wanted to come. So.
Okay.
But yeah, there was a couple of things. I suppose you go into organising the funeral. Is everything's on me. The majority of stuff is on me. Sarah's a primary school teacher. And when Cara was born, we had a priest that Sarah was close to. Father Jim came along and christened Cara up in the church in Slane. And yeah, absolutely lovely man. And Sarah was like, I want to contact Father Jim and I want to see if he's able to do it. And unfortunately, Father Jim had told us, look, I'm not in the greatest of health and I won't be able to. But he put us in touch with another priest called Father Barry. And again, absolutely gorgeous man. And on the day, Father Jim actually came and supported Father Barry in delivering the Mass. And you're sort of put under pressure to have a funeral in your local church in a roundabout way. Like, they're sort of like, you know, it's best you do it, keep it local for the local priest. And we're thinking, well, I've no relationship with the local priest and I have no relationship with that church either. I've never been inside the front door, but I've been to Slane Church and I like Slane Church, and we're going to have it in Slane Church or else we're going to bring it somewhere totally different. So that's the options that we have. And Father Jim and Father Barry rang the Slane Church ahead and they spoke to the priest there. And the priest said, no problem at all. You can have the church. And we had been up there at some point over Christmas. And at Christmas in Slane Church, it's just magical. Like, the Christmas tree they have is huge. Like, I'd recommend to anyone going by the church at Christmas, just go in and have a look because they do an unbelievable job. And the smell of Christmas as you walk in the door of that church. And we said, can you ask them to keep the Christmas tree up? Because we didn't want a funeral of doom and gloom and darkness. We asked everyone to wear bright colours. We asked everyone, like, don't bring flowers, just wear something bright. To remember Isla by, we would always say purple is Isla's colour. Like, she didn't go in a white baby girl when she was born. She was in a purple one. Like, it was like, everything is always colour in our house. Like, and, but they agreed, they kept the Christmas tree up. It was due to go down that Monday and they actually kept it up till the 15th for us. And yeah, so Isla goes to the funeral home on the Monday. We go up, I go in and I see her first and I see what she looks like. And then Sarah comes in after I've told her, look, it's okay to come in. We've got a little bit of time there with her. And then the doors open for people to come up and see Isla.
How was that time for both of you to spend it with her?
Yeah, you're still not fully tuned in, are you? At that point, you're sitting there. I'm holding her in my arms. I'm looking at her. I'm thinking how gorgeous she is, but she suddenly has a hat on now because the autopsy. You can't take the hat off because of what you might see. But yeah, she doesn't really look like herself. She does and she doesn't. Like, she's a little bit chubbier in the face and because of whatever they do. It's different for both of us at this stage because even though I don't want to be there in the funeral home, I'm grateful that I'm there. Sarah's obviously grateful that she's there, but we made the decision after that to we had this idea that we would bring Isla home that night and she would spend the night with us.
Yeah.
And as we were leaving, Sarah said, I can't do it. I can't have her home tonight. Like, I can't. And the funeral director agreed, look, you don't have to bring her home. You can bring her home anytime you want to. So why don't I look after her here tonight and you two head home, try get some sleep, and I'll give you a shout in the morning and we'll organise to drop her off. So that's what we did. We went home ourselves. And after hundreds and hundreds of people walking through, and like, I hate that part of a funeral. Even for me, if I go to someone's funeral, I really struggle to walk up. I'd rather catch them outside the church and just say something to them than go up and queue and have these random people shaking my hands. And like, I didn't know most people. Sarah has the widest group of friends you'll ever meet. Mm. And they're all good friends as well. And then you'd meet people and you're nearly second guessing who's who. Like, one man came up and shook my hands. I just presumed it was someone that Sarah knew. It was the man that owns a cafe up in the Hill of Tara had made his way over.
Oh, stop.
And and still to this day, like, I'd love to go up and say something to him, but I haven't been able to. The doctor that was in the cafe with me helped me. I have his phone number on my phone and I haven't brought myself to send him a message yet.
You will in time.
Yeah, I actually went to the guard and I said, this is his name, can you find him for me? And the guards came back and they said, here's his phone number. That was months ago. I haven't been able to bring myself to text him. But we go home on the Monday night, Tuesday, Isla's dropped over to the house. Tom is up now with us at this point. He, as you come into the house, on the left-hand side is the window. The basket that Isla's in has to stay by the window because that's the coolest part of the house.
Yeah.
I said to Tom, look, she's in there, but you don't have to look at her. You don't have to go near her. You don't have to do anything you don't want to do. Like, if you want to go up to your room and stay in your room, you stay in your room. You do whatever you want to do. And he did that. He came in and he went off and he did his own thing. He didn't come near her initially. But then he came back down in his own time and he wanted to see her and he wanted to hold her and he wanted to be with her. So you let him do it. You let him do it. Like, there's no rule book to say this is the right way or the wrong way. Should Tom go to the funeral in the church? Should Ayla go to the funeral in the church? Should my sister's kids go? You know, like, is it a time for them? No child should be introduced to death at that young age, especially when you can't explain it. Be different if there was something wrong and I could say, this is why. Also, but you can't.
Also to see a tiny baby, you know.
And to hold her. And to say, oh my God, Dad, she's so cold. Like, but I stand by that it's the right decision to have.
Absolutely.
Have him there.
If that's what he wanted, yeah. 100%.
Yeah. And you know, like, lots of people called in and out of the house that day on the Tuesday. We mentioned earlier, like, my grandparents hadn't been in great health in the build up to Christmas. And the decision was made that, like, we wouldn't go and see them and they wouldn't come down and see us. Like, we didn't want anyone passing anything on. My granddad's 93. He came in, he held Ayla, and he cried, and he cried, and he cried. 93 years old, like, sitting there. And we talk about, like, there's a generation of men who aren't in touch with their feelings. One of the best people I have to sit down and talk to is my granddad. Don't agree with him all the time, but I think that's part of the conversation is like we've talked about what happens next and where it goes. And like he's lost a sister when he was younger. He lost a brother when he was younger, but he also had a brother when he passed away a couple of weeks ago. That's 105. Like, he just his whole thing was he never got to meet her. He always had a thing about Sarah. Like, my granddaddy always said, like, when he met Sarah straight away, before we had Cara or Ayla, like, oh, Sarah has a real maternal energy about her. Like, she's always, if anyone should be a mom, it should be Sarah. Like, so yeah, we've family coming in and out. The road we live on, it's a busy enough road, but like, everyone knows each other's name, but you stick to them yourself. And we had the neighbours call in a couple of days after, or that later on that evening, the Tuesday evening. They didn't know anything had happened. They just saw all the people coming in and out. And they looked up an RIP, whatever reason they got, and they knocked on the door late that Tuesday night to offer their condolences. And that was it. Word starts to filter out then what's happened. And then you have the Wednesday morning, the funeral. So we decided it wasn't right for Tom to stay in the house with us that night. So Tom stayed in a hotel nearby with his mum. Just thought it was going to be too emotional for him. Cara was different. You could put her to bed at 7 and that was it. Yeah. We knew we'd have the time ourselves there. We wake up for the funeral. We get Cara ready. I think my mum and dad came and took her away. And then we had a little bit of time, just us and Ayla in the house. And, you know, like, some people talk about, like, that part where, like, you're putting the lid on the coffin, and I didn't think about it too much. Like, Sarah has done, because she was a primary school teacher, she's organised all the prayers, all the music. Mm. She has done all of that, and I've just done whatever else had to be done around it. We had so many people pull in around us that we never expected anything from. Parents of pupils that Sarah had taught, offering to come and sing, offering to do different jobs here and there. And yeah, we get up, we get showered, we get dressed. We look like we're going to a wedding more than a funeral. I'm wearing a blue suit with a pink shirt and a floral tie. And
is it a very different experience for both of you though, when you say you didn't think about it too much? And I know
definitely
I'm so interested in your experience.
Definitely.
But also just as Sarah, couples.
Sarah, like that part for her, like of
nearly killed
putting
her.
The lid back on the, and putting the lid on. I wasn't thinking, this is the last time I'm ever going to see Ayla. I don't know what I was thinking. I was thinking, we've got to get up to the church and get through this. And then I'll figure it all out after. That's the honest truth.
Let's just do it.
So she comes down the stairs and we took a blanket that Sarah's aunt had passed away a while before, but she had knitted a gorgeous blanket, and we put that blanket in the basket with Ayla. And then we put the lid on and we went out to the car. It's just a Jeep. And I sit on one side, Sarah sits on the other, and Ayla goes in between us. And we start to make that journey up to the church. And in the build up to those days where you're sitting at home, like I'm not great for journaling, like at all. Like, but Sarah's brilliant for it. Like she wrote down everything. She wrote letters to Ayla, like, but for me, all I could do was think about, okay, what has to happen? And I thought, okay, I really want to say something at the end of the mass. Like, I really want to say something. So I started writing a poem. Never wrote a poem before in my life. Never read it out in the end. I read something else out that Sarah asked me to read, and I just said a couple of words about, like, I mentioned that Sarah had that blood clot after a section, like, and I think I said something along the lines of, like, you know, she got over that blood clot, and we thought that was the worst 6 or 7 weeks that you will ever go through, and actually we're about to go through something even worse. And in the poem I write about, I mentioned earlier, like, I've Tom, and so that first miscarriage, you sort of cling onto the hope of, I have Tom. And then you have a second miscarriage and you cling on to that, I have Cara. But when your daughter dies, regardless of you having another son or another daughter, you still think of everything you would have done with that daughter. And I'm taking Ayla out of the back of that car into my arms, and I'm walking her up the aisle. No way that any dad should ever walk her. And I walk to the door of the church, and Tom comes beside me straight away, and he holds on to me on one side, and Cara's holding on to Sarah, and we walk up to the front of the church. And yeah, like, you get up there, you get up to the front and you put her down, and you're greeted by a wave of people coming towards you to offer you hugs and handshakes and whatever. And I'm just thinking, just let's get this out of the way and let's move forward. Let's just get me away from all these people, is essentially what I'm thinking. And the mass happens. The two priests, unbelievable men. They've checked in so much, like, since, and Cara being Cara and not having a clue was running wild around the church. My dad's chasing her. Look, she gives us a laugh, if anything else. People are laughing at her as they go through. But then, like I said, it was a sunny day, and where we were sitting in the front row of that church, there's a ray of light coming in, and the only two people that light is hitting is us. You're just thinking, what the hell? This is only when you start to reflect on it after, and you're thinking, wow, like. And then the mass ends and I say a few words, and then I go back to pick Ayla back up and carry her back out to church again. And put her in the back of the car. And you're greeted then by, again, a wave of people of coming up and offering their condolences. And Sarah's much better at that side of things than I would be. But she got quite upset, and I was like, look, we do not have to do anything for anyone here today. Like, the only people we have to be here for is each other, and let's just get in the car and go. So we get in the car and we sat for a few minutes together. And we said, no, let's just get back out now and do this part. And she got back out and she shook hands and hugged and kissed and everything else that went with it. And then, yeah, eventually, like, you have to make that call that you're gone now from there. So we didn't know what we wanted to do with Ayla. We didn't know, like, do we want to... I think when I think about what I want to do, I don't want to be buried in the ground. Like, so we said, look, let's go to the crematorium. We had picked one. And again, the funeral director said, don't go there. There's a lovely little one that'll bring you to. It's more for kids. It's more intimate. It's a nice one. As nice as can be for that situation. So we went there in Harold's Cross. And yeah, look. It's all a blur. Like, it's not a blur, but like, there's nothing I can tell you about that moment that I go, well.
Yeah,
like, because she's put on a stage. We say a couple of words. Sarah gets up, says a couple of words to the few. It's just really close.
Yeah.
Immediate family, and then it's a couple of friends on either side, and that's it. And we've got nieces and nephews there as well, and like, sitting outside the church, outside the crematorium, crying. And like, one of my nieces, what happened? The innocence of like, not knowing.
Mm.
Or known, but not thinking. Like, just seeing Sarah crying on her hands and knees outside the crematorium. And yeah, finished there, booked for lunch, because that's what you do, isn't it? You go for food.
Yeah.
Worst decision ever.
Yeah.
Only regret through the whole process is going and sitting down and having a meal with everyone after. Because it's different. Like, we've recently went to a funeral down in Lahinch, actually. Sarah's uncle passed away. He was 93. And there was a dread of going down to that funeral. Like, thinking, this is the first one we've had to go to since Ayla passed away. We actually went to the house beforehand, and then we went up to the church briefly. But we soon realised, this isn't a sad occasion. Andy had an unbelievable life. He was loved by everyone. He was hardly sick. He has a story to tell for everything. This is a celebration of his life. We've had 8 weeks and 2 days. There's not that much to celebrate. What are we doing here having dinner with people? Like, why are we sitting doing this? And eventually we went. Everyone was still there. We left. We ate and we left. And we went home, and that's probably when the reality sinks in. Because we had a routine of how things worked in the house. Tom went home with his mum that night, and myself and Cara and Sarah went home. And the routine was, at 7 o'clock, I would go and give Cara her bath, get into the bed beside her, read her a story, and she'd nod off, and I'd go back down and make a cup of tea or a coffee for us or whatever. But while I was upstairs doing that, Sarah would feed Ayla, change Ayla, put her into her pajamas as well, and then put her down beside us. Instead, Sarah's sitting on the sofa with a breast pump and taking lettuce leaves out of her bra from the funeral that day, trying to dry up the milk being produced. And she would say that night sticks with her, where she's down there and her arms are aching because they're empty. She is on the sofa, and her routine of the past 2 months has just gone out the window. And there's a silence in the house that was never there before. And that, look, that silence is still there. It doesn't matter how many kids are in the house, how many, like, there's always going to be a missing void now. And yeah.
So I suppose, just to clarify for the listener as well, the cause of death for Ayla was?
Yep. So it's SIDS, or what would have been known as cot death beforehand. So sudden infant death syndrome. So essentially what it means is there is no reason. So they've tested her and they have found nothing whatsoever was wrong with her. We have agreed then to have further testing, which got sent off to the UK and Germany and the US, genetic testing. Nothing came back on that either. So, yep, just sudden infant death. It doesn't matter where we were or what we were doing. If it was going to have to, if it was going to happen, there was nothing we could have done to change it.
Okay.
She obviously hasn't gone back to work since. Sarah hasn't. The next few weeks, there were a little bit of a... I couldn't really tell you what we did or what we didn't do. Like, I think we just got up and survived.
Yeah.
Like all you're asking for at that point is you're getting all these messages of we're thinking about you. We're anything you need, let us know. Well, I can tell you now, anything I need, I don't have a clue what I need. I need you to tell me what I need. So I would always say to people now, if someone's passed away, no matter how young, no matter how old, don't wait for them to make a decision. Yeah. Don't make the decision for them.
They can't.
No.
Yeah.
And we had some unbelievable friends. One friend of Sarah's turned up at the door one day. She had a toddler the same age as Cara and a newborn baby and turned up with freshly baked bread and loads of food. And I'm thinking, you do not need to be down this.
But that's what you need.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. And yeah, so like the next few weeks, it really is just a blur. You're waiting to find out, okay, what the next steps are. You're told the autopsy should have an answer in maybe 3 months. Then that gets pushed out to a few more and a few more and a few more. But during that period, I've taken maybe 3 weeks off work, I'm saying, and I've decided, okay, I'll go back to work. I need to do this. And I'm dreading walking into the office. And I'm thinking, here I go, funeral home all over again, queue of people coming up to see me. And the job that I do, that I was doing at the time was like I would know the majority of people who were in the office because of the job I was doing. So straight away, I can see people coming up to me. And I'm okay about it, surprisingly. And hugs, kisses, handshakes, everything's happening. And I'm like, okay. Then I'm seeing people walk by my desk at the corner of my eye and I'm seeing them swiftly come back and say, I can't walk by you. I have to say, I don't know what to say, but I have to say something to you. I'm thinking, okay, this is okay being in here. Like, I can do this. The next day, following thing happens again, lots of people up and down to me. And then I go to work from home the following couple of days. And it's only when I go back the second week that I'm like, what the hell am I doing here? Because everyone saw me the week before. And everyone else's lives had gone back to normal. There was work that had to be done. But I'm sitting there on my laptop looking around and everything is going 100 miles an hour around me and my laptop is on. I could not tell you what I was doing. And I had asked for some work to do and in fairness, my two managers were saying, look, like just take your time, break into it. I was getting invited to pointless meetings. They'd see me sitting at my desk by myself. They come and say, why don't you join this meeting? And I'm like, what's it about? And they tell me, I said, that's nothing to do with me. So it was nearly just that I wasn't sitting there by myself. And I guess in 3 to 4 weeks went by and I just went to them and said, look, I'm going to take some time off. And I decided that I would take 6 months off and concentrate on things at home. In the meantime, Sarah has just gone full blown into like research as to what we can do support wise. So after 2 weeks, both of us are speaking to counsellors. 2 weeks after Ayla passed away, I'm dealing with one that I've dealt with for a number of years through work. And Sarah's got support from a charity, First Light, who have provided a therapist to her. And we're speaking to them and you're trying to make sense of everything. And for me, I'm just reliving that day over and over and over. And the way it was described, Sarah actually described it great. She said, if you know the story, I'm going on a bear hunt. She said, that's what we're going through now. We're going on a bear hunt and this trauma and this grief that you're going through, like you can't go over it and you can't go under it. You have to go through it. And Sarah's definitely worse than me at this point. Like I am functioning. She's a teacher in Dublin, but she's actually taught around the Navan area before. So she knows everyone. She can't go shopping. She can't do anything. If I'm out and there's no milk in the house, then you're just getting no milk. That was it. Like she wasn't going to the shop to pick it up. For me, I could go and do the food shop. I could put my headphones on. I could go walking. I could do whatever had to be done. Everything else around me was a blur. I would go in, I'd get what I have to, and I'd get back out again. For me, escaping the house was getting some time to cry, getting some time to get my own thoughts together in my head and figuring out what had to be done.
Did you find a sense of, I suppose, not responsibility, but did you find, I suppose, as a man or as the dad or whatever, did you find like I have to be held together, composed, slash strong, slash whatever you want to call it?
Yeah, and I think as the further our story goes on, the more you realise that that's the case, because it is me doing everything at this stage. Like I've said before, people who've heard me talk about Ayla and heard me talk about Sarah. Sarah is a brilliant cook, but she stopped cooking. She would be obsessed with having clean floors. She'll kill me for saying this, but she is obsessed with having clean floors. Those floors would be mopped every day if she had a choice. And like you're picking up absolutely everything. Okay. And at this stage here now, I'm questioning myself as in, why am I getting more upset? But I know at the same time I can go out and I can put some music on. And like when I was going to work that time, I decided that I'd drive to work and that I could have a good cry from A to B and then I'd pull myself together and it'd be grand when I got to the office. And yeah, you do. You think of all that. And like I said, Sarah has immersed herself now in a world of grief at this point. She is reading about it. She's listening to it. She is contacting groups on Facebook or whatever other social media platform. She's reaching out to people all over the world, trying to get an understanding. And I think initially when this happens, you go searching for, I need to find that same person that's gone through what I've gone through.
Show me there's someone surviving this.
Yeah. And it has to be this. It can't be anything else.
Yeah.
So we joined an online support group for parents with the charity A Little Lifetime Foundation, and we came across a bereavement counsellor there, Peter Hanlon. And Peter made the recommendation that we go to, based on having Tom and having Cara, that we go to a bereavement camp in Barrettstown. Mm. So most people, when they hear Barrettstown, they think, oh, sick kids.
Mm.
And I didn't want to go. Straight away, I didn't want to go. And I think this is probably the case for most men now, like that I meet and I talk to is, oh yeah, my wife made me go, my partner made me go, or they said we had to do it, so we just did it. And we went to Barrettstown and we went separately. I had to pick Tom up to bring him, and you arrive on a Thursday and there's a long driveway up to Barrettstown, and every 100 to 50 metres to 100 metres, you meet like a Billy Barry kid singing and dancing. How are you? How's your trip? How's that? And you're thinking, calm down. Like, you were way too happy for me. So I got there first and I messaged Sarah. I said, just prepare yourself for coming in. Like, they're very, very happy. And you go in and look, I spoke to someone about this at the weekend that's going to Barrettstown next year. And this is the best thing you can ever do. I absolutely hated that first weekend. If you had to give me the option to get in my car on the Friday and go home after being there one day on the Thursday, I would have went.
Like, you know, I obviously do that work now as well. Yeah. I have days where people come and things like that. And I'm always trying to tell people, like, you don't have to talk. You don't have to participate. Mm. You might come back in 2 years and be a whole different person, you know?
Yeah.
So I suppose I just want to kind of touch on, I suppose, from there, you know, you're not even a year in, you've celebrated Ayla's birthday, which I'm sure was absolutely horrific in its own way.
Mm-hmm.
There's two kind of things I wanted to chat to you about is, I suppose, I often hear this, couples, it can break a relationship, a loss. Number one, you're living under the same roof and have two very different experiences. It's very difficult and you're both grieving the same person, the same loss, but you can grieve it very differently. Not to mention just, you know, your own marriage, your own relationship, having to rear Cara, Tom. Mm. Has it put a strain on your relationship?
Yeah. In one word, yeah. You're told at the start, we were told by a bereavement counsellor that a lot of relationships end up breaking up. Not because of you've lost a child. Like, they were probably going to break up anyway, but this will just fast track that process.
Okay.
So, yeah, definitely. I think there's an element of selfishness that comes into grieving that has to be there.
Yeah, you're right.
And at the start, myself and Sarah, like, I did everything I could to help her. Absolutely everything. And there came a time where she started to pick up stuff around the house again, cooking, cleaning, whatever it might be, dropping Cara off somewhere. And the trauma and the grief that hit me, it hit me physically. So I started to see an energy healer because I couldn't walk. My left leg just went. And I was basically told, Sarah's giving you permission now to let it all out. So let it out. And still to this day, I'm on my way here and my ankle is throbbing when I'm on the way. But as I'm talking to you, I can feel no pain whatsoever in my ankle. So I see him on a regular basis. Every couple of weeks I go and see him and he will pick up on where the trauma is sitting or where that grief is sitting within me. I think that to go back to the original point about does it put a strain, I think what happens now is very different. Like, we've marked Ayla's first birthday. People tell us that the build up to the birthday is worse than the actual day. That's a load of rubbish. The actual day is terrible.
For you guys, it was, that was your experience of it.
Like, grief comes in waves. So, you know, it's all good. If Sarah's on top of the wave and I'm under the wave, we can manage it. So as you go up and down, you can manage that grief.
But there could be a day where you're both under the wave.
And that's where
you need outside support comes. Sometimes.
That's where I'm looking at Sarah going,
I can't.
I have helped you so much. All I need is this one day. And I can be, she will tell you, like, I am not the nicest person to be around in those days. I haven't had many of them, but it's me having an expectation of her that I shouldn't have. That I'm saying, you need to pull me up here. You need to stop me from drowning like the way I've pulled along for you. And like, I think there's two sides to it. Like, Sarah doesn't acknowledge how far she's come. We went swimming yesterday with Cara. And Cara's, I haven't been swimming in so long with her. And I was amazed. And I was like, that's all you, Sarah, that has got her to that stage. And there's so much that she does. And it's definitely hard. Puts a strain. And I think you need to be aware of it. And I think you need to have that point where you can go, I need to step away. I need to go. And I have those outlets. And she has hers. But the problem is when a significant date comes around.
You're both.
And you want to be together. But you also want to be apart. You want to get that anger out or you want to let it out. And sometimes from my point of view, because I've seen how far Sarah's come along, I'm thinking to myself, I can't let her know how bad I'm feeling because it's going to pull her back down with me. She's up there. She needs to keep going upwards.
So you try to hide it.
I don't need to pull her down. I try to hide it, but I'm terrible at hiding it. She knows straight away.
Well, this is the thing. The perception I would have of men and dads would be hiding it and I'm fine and diminishing it. Do you see that you are allowed to or is that something you still struggle with?
Definitely allowed to, but I would definitely still, even though I know I'm allowed to, I would definitely do it in my own way. I would definitely leave the house and let it out. Or I would, like I mentioned, Tom lives in Cork. I've got a 3-hour trip down where I can get all the emotions out that I want to.
The car is unbelievable.
Oh, the car is great.
Isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Put on the saddest playlist that you have on your phone.
Get it out.
Yeah. Have Ayla's picture as the playlist and she's up on the front of the screen and I can cry my eyes out the whole way down. I'm sure I'm stopped in traffic and people are looking, going, who's the weirdo, like crying his eyes out?
Listen, I can tell you now, there's a wealth of people listening to this right now in their car. Getting it out.
Yeah.
That's, you know, amazingly, that's what people say this podcast does. Mm. It's therapy for them. As I said, you're sitting here, you want to help so many people through talking. You've channeled that energy into your own podcast.
I have.
Now, interestingly, you've called it Dads Don't Cry.
Yeah.
Why did you call it Dads Don't Cry?
Well, it's obviously,
is that the stigma?
It's tongue in cheek.
Yes.
And you know what? And the great thing about this is it starts so many conversations. With Tom, number one, Tom sat down and helped me do the artwork for the podcast. And he was like, Dad, this is such a stupid name. Like, it's called Dad's Don't Cry. And you cry. You cry. So why are you calling it Dad's Don't Cry?
The sarcasm went over his head.
And I was speaking to a woman last week and she said, oh my God, I was telling someone I was listening to your podcast and I said, oh, Dad's Don't Cry. And before they even finished the sentence, the husband had turned around again. But they do. So, yeah, it's definitely tongue-in-cheek. Yeah. And like the aim of the podcast there is to create a safe space for anyone to come and speak about child loss. So I know, obviously, the platform you have is to speak about every type of loss, but it's specific to child loss. Because I mentioned earlier, you try to find the same situation that you're in, but soon you realise that actually any child loss, whether it be miscarriage, I've met so many people now, so many people. I'm part of a dad's group with Felicon. We meet up on a monthly basis to play sports or just to chat. And I've met people there who have had multiple miscarriages, who don't have kids now. Stillbirths who don't have kids now. And that loss to them is just as important as the loss of Ayla is to me.
I suppose I'll end on, for you, again, we're not even a year in. Do you feel like your grief has changed over time?
Sometimes I feel like it hasn't even hit me.
Possibly.
Yeah. So I've good days, I've bad days. I went back to work. I said, after I took the 6 months off and I went back, and the week of Ayla's birthday, I found out I was being made redundant. And so I had been back 3 weeks at that stage. And even though I felt like work didn't give me the same, I hadn't got the same drive for work as what I had before, I felt like I could do better in the world than what I was doing. It was giving me a focus. So like a Tuesday and a Wednesday, I went to the office and I was pushing to have corporate talks and men and grief and having different charities in to speak to the business and talk about what they do. That was all going quite well on top of my actual work. But the routine did me good being in work. Whereas now sometimes I wake up and I think, I picture myself not being able to get out of bed some days. Like I get up out of bed because I know I have to get up out of bed. If the day I stay in bed is the day that I'll probably keep staying in bed. So it's like, okay, I'll keep moving. I'll keep going forward. But yeah, like myself and Sarah are in each other's pockets now at the moment, and it probably doesn't do us good if, like I said, we're having a bad day or a good day, it's great. But the grief definitely changes. I definitely feel it. Again, emotionally, I feel it, but physically in my body, like I said, my ankle, constant throbbing. I go to the energy healer. He's able to tell me, I stopped going to therapy for 3 weeks. And I went back to the energy healer and he said to me, you stopped going to therapy. I can feel all that energy
is in your It's like that chest. Book, the body keeps the score, you know, if you hold on to it.
And you know, if you were to speak to anyone that knows me from before this, they would have thought, there's no way he'd believe it. I'd be laughing at you if you told me this.
I know.
And yet here I am. You lose a child and you will do absolutely anything to try grab that little bit of you that's lost and get it back.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming in today and being so open and honest with me. I've cried my way through it. Girls cry, we all cry, you know, and it's...
Dads don't cry.
Yeah, dads, I know. It's so good to normalise that, of course, we all cry and we feel that pain. I feel that pain with you today, you know, incredibly. I'm incredibly heartbroken for you and your family to lose a tiny little baby like that. It's just, it's very upsetting. I feel that pain with you. I'm sure the listeners feel that pain with you, and we will be thinking of you as you move forward.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.